is time.
Check it out, y'all.
You are now about to witness.
And it goes a little something like this.
Alexander Ovechkin curl and drag to the back end. He scores! Simply sensational! Brodeur looking for the goal! Down the ice! Score! Martin Brodeur!
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome back to another edition of the Game Time Decision Podcast. I'm your host, Colton Prale. Joining me today, it's Matt Kane, a hockey genius, Matt. I met you a couple of years ago back at a hockey analytics conference in Ottawa. You were talking about weighted shots, and I think that was actually for me like one of the first big moments where I started to get into analytics past Corsi and Fenwick, and that just like opened up a whole new world to me. Was that conference and the stuff that was discussed there. So I am so excited to have you on the show today because there is so much I want to talk about, and we will get to that weighted shot information, that piece. If you want to learn more about Matt, read some of his work, follow him. You can find him on Twitter at @Kane_Matt. You can read his work at puckplusplus.com or at hockeygraphs.com. And now his newest stuff at Winners View, because you, sir, just got a job in hockey. You are in the biz. You're a hockey mind now.
I'm in the biz, and now I feel a terrible amount of pressure with the hockey genius introduction to say something clever, groundbreaking.
I am sure you will wow us and enthrall us with your knowledge.
I would describe myself as a not hockey idiot, hopefully. And that's as much as confidence as I have in mind. But
that is a good start.
I'm very excited to be here.
All right. So I opened this series up, and I've done past series. If you want to check those out, by the way, episode 1, 2, and 3 already with Rachel Dory, Sean Tierney, and Ian Fleming on goaltender statistics, data visualization, and hockey tactics and video work. You can find all of those in the description down below on this podcast. But Matt, I've opened up this series every time with the same question, which is, if you had to explain hockey analytics or hockey statistics to someone who is new to the community, how would you describe 1, where we've been, 2, where we are, and 3, where we're going?
All right. So how can I do this succinctly? I guess I started looking at hockey analytics back in 2013. And at that point, it had been around for a lot longer than for years and years and years at that point. I think what we understood like a lot of the like core tenets, a lot of the same things that we do now. We understood that having the puck, that possessing the puck, that getting the most shot attempts in a game is a good thing. We understood that score effects were a thing, that your rate of shot attempts could be impacted and sometimes somewhat significantly by the current score of the game. We understood when I got into it that players didn't have a ton of impact on their shooting and save percentages, and I don't remember where this happened in the grand evolution of things, but we were starting to understand that there were definitely players who had a stronger impact on shooting percentage than other players, and that it wasn't, paint everyone with one brush shooting percentage. But we basically were at the place when I first got into this that we understood really well what made, in general, teams and players good. From a pure like metrics point of view. And I think we were starting to get to the point with a lot of the tracking projects that were going on when I first started reading and writing about this, of understanding why certain players were good at that. And so I look at, over the last few years, things like zone entries and zone exits that were tracked by Eric Tulsky or by Corey Schneider, the passing project. Those are really where we are right now. We're starting to get a lot more understanding of how players generate, let's say, good shot attempt statistics or generate higher quality chances, as some players are able to do. We understand that because of the detailed work that people have done in going through and sitting down and watching every game and writing down every time someone entered the zone or exited the zone. So, I mean, if you want to understand where we are now, we've gone beyond just, Corsi is good, shot attempts are good. We understand now how perhaps some players generate better Corsi percentages than others do. We understand from a shot quality perspective, how some players are able to impact it both offensively and probably to a lesser extent defensively by things like passing. Where we're going in the future, I think we're going to continue to see this trend towards more and more detailed micro stats. I think with a lot of the tracking companies, both video and manual tracking companies, we're starting to get a lot more of a granular picture of what goes on in every game. And I think over the next few years, and whether this occurs publicly or in the private sector within teams and within organizations, we're going to start to get a lot better sense as to which of those micro statistics are really valuable in evaluating a player and in hopefully identifying more specific skill sets. Because I think what we're pretty good at now is saying which players are generally good or bad. We're not really great at saying if you need to fill in a spot on your roster with a guy who will reduce your shot attempts against, specifically on shifts starting in the defensive zone. So you need a defenseman to start in the defensive zone. Who do you go out and get? We don't necessarily have the data right now to do that. And I think in the next few years, that's really going to be a big area where people can, where we'll find a lot more value in the metrics that we're able to develop.
That is a very, very good explanation of where we are right now. The one thing I think of when you mentioned that is Garrett Hole's infographic on inputs and outputs and how that gives us a total evaluation. And I think the biggest thing is we're going to be looking at a lot more of the inputs rather than the outputs, you know, instead of just the Corsi, how are they getting that shot attempt percentage or how are they getting that shutdown style of play? If you had to recommend to people who are just getting into the hockey analytics or hockey statistics community, a couple of names to read just to get them started, who would you throw out there?
I'm obviously going to start with a lot of my colleagues at Hockey Graphs. I think Garrett has built up a great super all-star team of writers there, and they're constantly churning out really interesting content across really like a broad array of the different areas where analytics can touch upon. You get people who are looking at which coaches are best. You get people who are looking at really tactical, strategic, in-game microstat sort of stuff like Ryan Stimson. You get the big picture modeling guys like DTM About Hart. And you get people who sort of do it all. You get the Carolyn Wilkies or the if Nick ever wrote something, the Nick Mercadantes of the world. And of course I'd also be remiss not to mention someone like Micah McCurdy, whose work is at hockeyviz.com, who just does a tremendous job on basically any interesting topic that you can think of and has a way to really simplify a lot of complex ideas and complex, like multifaceted problems, like things like wowies into really simple and easy to understand visualizations.
Yeah, he has a real talent for that. And if you want to learn more about that, you can check out the past episode two we did with was on Sean Tierney and his work with data visualization. We talked a lot about Micah in that one. And if you've noticed, this whole series in general has been just picking off the big names at Hockey Graph so far. So yeah, you're bang on with the authors you named. Actually, the first person to not name Tulski. I know he's a little older now, but his archived work is what I would go with.
Oh, definitely. If he starts writing again publicly, I think the Hurricanes number one will be a little bit upset.
Yeah.
But if you're just getting into this and you're looking for the foundational core, the Hockey Analytics 101, all of his work is you know essential reading to understand where we've come from, to often understand what we've tried that didn't work in the past, because he did a lot of work just dispelling a lot of the ideas about how much impact players can have on shooting or save percentage. And that's really contributed to our understanding of what's valuable today.
He has grandfathered a lot of the work that we are working on now. A little bit more into the stuff that you've done, though. We've talked a lot about other people. One of my favorite pieces that you did was you looked at weighted shot values and how that helps us understand shot quality. And now we've got metrics like expected goals. How would you explain to someone who's new to that idea, the idea that, you know, not only do shots differ, but over time it might regress, but there are, you know, better quality shots that you can take, and it's worth putting weight into that.
So weighted shots is actually an idea that Tom Tango came up with. And Tom Tango is a baseball hockey analytics, you know, he's a do-all, very, very, very smart person who understands both the technical side and also has a really good grasp on how these skills and these abilities that we look for might manifest themselves in the data that we have. So he has a ton of great ideas, and weighted shots was one of them. And basically the idea behind weighted shots, which I sort of picked up once he wrote about it and ran with it in a few different ways, is that Corsi is sort of an extreme end of the spectrum of how we can possibly weight things. On the one end, you have Corsi, where every type of shot attempt is worth the same. On the other end, you have plus minus, where only goals are worth anything, and save shots and miss shots and block shots are worth zero. Weighted shots is in the middle of that spectrum. And what it says is that we know that goals are worth more. We know that certain players may have a stronger, or certain teams may have a stronger ability to impact whether a given shot attempt is likely to become a goal. And so we shouldn't treat every shot the same. There's information in the fact that a goal occurred that we want to use. And we don't want to use only that, because we know that Corsi is better than just using plus minus or just using goals for percentage. But we also know that if we, you know, go in and we do the math, that goal data contains a lot more information than just a pure Corsi number will do. So what weighted shots kind of captures, and one of the reasons that I like it, is that if you think about going beyond just Corsi, there are two ways in which a shot's likelihood of going in can be increased. The first is that it can be a better quality shot. So it can be taken from closer into the net, or it can be a rebound or on a rush, or, you know, any of those other, across the Royal Road as an example. Any of those other factors that we know impact in general the likelihood from the situational side of things. And that's generally what I think we call shot quality. The other side of it is just finishing ability. So we know that some shooters, regardless of where the shot is or how good of a shot it is, they're going to score more goals per expected goal, quote unquote, than other shooters. So there are guys like Steven Stamkos, who are always going to have an above average shooting percentage, because no matter where they're shooting from on the ice, they are more accurate shooters. They're harder shooters. They're going to put the puck in more often on a given shot than other players. And then there are guys like Eric Condra, who, if they're standing in front of the net, are probably going to miss it anyways. So weighted shots, it doesn't try to solve those problems independently. What it really does is it says, we know that some players are going to be good at shot quality and some players are going to be good at finishing. And let's just lump those two skills in together and we'll regress it a little bit. And we'll come out with a number that says a goal is worth, let's say, five times what a non-goal is worth. And so it starts to give a bit more credit to the players who are creating more high quality shots, or from the defensive side, players who are allowing higher quality shots against.
And you touched on it briefly, but how does that mesh with the current expected goal models that we have right now? Does it add to it? Is it a bit of a contrasting idea? How would you work them together?
I think they're complementary views. I think that depending on the expected goals model, for example, the one that I think most of us use on Corsica.hockey, that's a pure expected goals model in the sense that it looks at where the shot was taken from and some of the contextual factors and says, how likely is it to go in? It ignores the shooters completely. With DTM about Hart's model, it includes the shooters. So that brings a bit of the finishing technique in. But where this differs is that it gives a bit more credit, and it probably it probably gives a bit more credit to players who score the goals, whereas in the expected goals model, it'll give more credit to the location of it. So you end up with a little bit more on the shooter rather than on the other players on the ice under a weighted shots model. Whereas with the expected goals model, you know, everyone gets credit for that same expected goals, depending on what statistic you're looking at.
Now, I'm just thinking of this now, so don't, if it's been done or if it can't be done, let me know. But could you use this almost inversely to look at goaltenders and say, how are they performing against shots that have a higher weighted shot value?
You could do that with the expected goals. With weighted shots, it's going to be a bit trickier. You could, in theory, create a way of evaluating them that looks at, you know, for every shot attempt, how many weighted shots do they have? Mm-hmm. And that's going to be related in part to shooting percentage. It's going to be sort of a regress shooting percentage again. So you get a bit of a quality of competition metric, and you can start to look at, you know, if a goalie is playing in the Metropolitan Division this year, where, you know, the teams all seem to be a step above everyone else in the league right now, are those goalies facing more difficult shots, and should we be adjusting for it that way?
That's interesting. It's just a thought I had as you were explaining that. A lot of the work that you've done, though, outside of this project has focused a lot on special teams. Is that an area that you feel is underrepresented? I mean, I know five on five play, is about 70% of the game time, but, you know, special teams is a factor. We've seen it. You want to look at the World Juniors right now, Team Canada. They seem to struggle on 5-on-5. You put them on the power play, and there's just too much talent. Is this an area that you think is maybe underlooked, undervalued, or is exploitable to teams?
Definitely. And I think it's one of the weird areas because, like you said, 70% of the game occurs at 5-on-5, but I think something like 35% of the goals are scored on special teams. And when you look at what's actually been done, there hasn't been a ton of research on what makes a player good on the power play or on the penalty kill, but also what makes a system good on the power play or the penalty kill. And so we don't have a great understanding of how much value a player can add there. One of the reasons that that's so is that when you look at which players are good at 5-on-5, you kind of expect them to be the same players who are generally going to do well on the power play, but you don't always, that's not always necessarily the same case. That's not always necessarily the case. And so being able to identify, particularly from a systems point of view, what systems work and to find the, let's say, analytical markers of a successful power play or penalty kill is kind of one of the big open problems out there that we probably need better data to really start digging into. We can look at, you know, we generally know that high shot attempt teams do well on the power play and teams that don't allow a lot of shot attempts will do well on the penalty kill. But above and beyond that, we don't have a lot of insight into which formations are important. Or if you are not the trigger man on a power play, if you're the four other guys on the ice with Alex Ovechkin, how do we know whether you're doing your job well or not? And tracking data, passing data, all of those microstats will help us understand that. But I think we're still at the point now where we have kind of a broad understanding of who may be useful and what teams may be good on the power play or the penalty kill. But we don't have a detailed view of, you know, for 35% of the goals, what's really contributing to them.
And Dmitry Filipovich had a fantastic piece on this on Sportsnet the other day where he showed how structured the Columbus power play was. And you can see that when a power play is structured in such a way, not necessarily in the 1-3-1 formation, but just everyone knows their role and everyone adheres to their role strictly, that's when things come together and that's when things work. And he showed how Sam Gagne is effective on the power play. And I think finding more players like that is interesting. I was looking into the Senators recently. Their power play is shooting at a very similar rate to last year when they had Dave Cameron behind the bench coaching the special teams. And he's not a good special teams coach. He just isn't. I'm sorry to say it, Dave. But look at the work he's doing in Calgary. It's not his forte. Now they've got Guy Boucher. He's supposed to be a power play specialist. They're shooting the puck at about the same rate. They're a little better. Mike Hoffman is playing way more than he did under Cameron, but is it a significantly better power play? There's really no statistics that we can point to say, yeah, this is much, much better because of the formation, rather than just, you know, they're over-relying on Hoffman and he's a strong goal scorer. And so that's where I think the work that you're doing could be vital for something like this, because like you said, so many goals are coming on special teams. It's an area that's still relatively raw and that could be exploited. And I appreciate the work you're doing.
Oh, for sure. And this is where we kind of miss like a lot of the work that someone like Eric Parnas was doing, where mm-hmm. he was doing the really detailed deep dives into what makes specific teams succeed and what makes specific teams fail, and watching every second of every power play yep. to really know, you know, what formations are working, how important are zone entries and getting into formation, and really that, like you said, that structure and that having that structure in those roles is a key part of the power play. But unless you're watching every game, it's more difficult to tell whether teams are successful doing that. I think one of the cool things I've seen recently was Micah McCurdy put together charts that I think Dmitry Filipovich had in his article, showing where specifically shooters were shooting from on the power play. And you could kind of see which teams had spots where they were sending guys to and which teams were a bit more either organized chaos or just chaos on the power play, for lack of a better term. So I think there's probably a lot to be done with that. But at the same time, I do think that we just need either someone to sit down and do the manual work, the hard work to fill in the blanks and in the data that we have, or a very generous data company to just give us access to their data.
That's the dream. Just have someone offer all of those, some RFID chips on players, all the passes. That'd be perfect. Save Ryan a lot of work, because his project, I think, is going to help with this a lot. The down low passes, the cross ice passes, I think we're going to see a lot more information on how it can be effective to spread the opposition on the power play. It's a completely anecdotal observation, but from the graphs Mika put out, it seemed that the teams that did better, one, were structured, two, were often in a 1-3-1, and three, made the opposition play a really tight game. They were closer to the net, and they always had a fairly solid net front presence. And I know a big body isn't huge, and Rachel and I talked about this in last week's episode about the idea of a static screen on the power play, and she has some really interesting comments to say about that, but it depends where you are. If you are in position and you're playing your game and you're in front of the net and you're being an effective body in front of the net, I think that can have a real impact. And I think eventually we will get to a point where the data can show that. As of yet, not there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that having that structure and just knowing what your system's going to do, and knowing that that person is going to be there, or the everyone is going to be in their position, makes it easier to have perhaps the creativity that allows you to build off that as well. And again, like you said, hopefully the data is going to be there to back that up, or maybe we're all completely wrong and there's this new random complete chaos style that is really the best way to play, but we won't know.
That's called the Sharks power play. Just fire the puck as much as you can.
Yeah, exactly.
You've done some really interesting work with rebound control for defensemen and for goalies. How important do you think is it that defensemen are able to clear the crease, or that goalies can direct play after rebound? Is this something we should expect to see more research into once RFID chips come into play, or?
Definitely, because I think one of the interesting things that these RFID chips and all the tracking data really is going to give us is the ability to test out a lot of the old, I don't want to call them old school theories, but the traditional views on what makes a defenseman good. And this is like one of those things that everyone says: they can clear the puck out from in front of the net. They are the guys who will move the bodies and who will, you know, clean up the garbage. And to a degree, like there's not a lot of reason for us with the stats we have now to doubt that. But at the same time, with goalies and with defensemen, there's a bit of variability in their rebound statistics. And a lot of that is that, you know, there's not a lot of rebounds in general on a per game basis. So it takes a long time for the signal to separate itself from the noise. But with goalies, it's definitely, there's a weak signal, I think, of rebound control, both in the sense of number one, either freezing the puck, but also number two, in not allowing a rebound when you don't freeze the puck. With defensemen, it's again a little bit of a weaker signal, and that's just because there's even less data on a seasonal basis. But it's something where when we start to know who's in position when a shot is taken and what they do in that position and how they react to a let's call it a rebound opportunity occurring, we'll start to get a lot better sense as to which players, if any, are able to make that move to either cut off the rebound to gain control of the puck or to get in the way of your opponent who perhaps is trying to get the rebound off of you and to get a shot off.
And eventually the hope then is that we'll be able to determine how a player impacts or doesn't impact save percentage. I mean, that's the end goal, right? It's figure out who is a better defender.
Oh, for sure. And it's one of those areas where I think right now we're a lot weaker at valuing defense than we are at valuing offense. And this information will probably be really important in helping us figure out which skaters, you know, actually have that ability to come out and to protect that lead on a defensive zone faceoff. Kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier, where we don't have a lot of sense right now as to which players are good in specific roles, simply because the data that we have doesn't really, you know, allow us to evaluate it that well. This data will definitely allow us to say, you know, down if you're up by one with 2 minutes left to play and you've got a defensive zone faceoff coming up, you're expecting a shot against and maybe to have to clear out a rebound or two. You know, this is the guy who should be on the ice, or this is the guy who definitely shouldn't be on the ice.
Out of the work that you've done and the results, which I understand are not the clearest, would you expect that perhaps the more visually defensive defenseman would succeed in a scenario like this? Or do you think maybe it'll be players who, again, have been underrated for their defensive game, players who are, you know, have an active stick, so to speak?
I think it'll be a mix. I think there's definitely going to be guys, at least based on the work that I've seen, who are good at preventing second or third shot attempts. Some of the work that I did last year looked at whether players were able to prevent future shot attempts after an initial shot attempt. So it's not just rebounds, but it's basically everything after that first shot attempt occurs. How well did you play in that scenario? And there were players who had that sort of traditional reputation as a defensive defenseman who scored very well on this, even though they were allowing an absolute ton of initial shot attempts. So their Corsi wasn't very good, but they weren't allowing a lot of follow-up attempts, which I think is where that's what people see. They see that they get the play under control. Even if they're not necessarily moving the puck up the ice, they're preventing those second attempts and they're not generating offense, but they're staunching the bleeding, for lack of a better word. Interestingly, though, a lot of the offensive guys who were maybe criticized for a lack of defensive skill also did well by this metric. So it's not as cut and dry as just pure reputation will show up in these metrics, or at least I don't think it is. But I do think it'll give a clearer picture than, you know, the sort of ad hoc thrown together metric that I put together last year. And it'll particularly be interesting to identify what I would call like individual responsibility for this. So if you've got two defensemen, who's the one doing the heavy lifting and preventing these? Is it, you know, the player or his or her partner who's really who's clearing out the front of the net and collecting those loose pucks?
And sort of along those lines, there's a player who's been, what's the polite way to call this? A headline grabber over the past little bit. Plays for Edmonton, wears number 4, Chris Russell. He's everyone's favorite. There's an article that came out about a week ago by David Staples, and it's called "Analytics Experts Say Chris Russell of Edmonton Oilers is Underrated and One of NHL's Top Defensive Defensemen." There's a lot of claims in that article. a lot of really strange ones that we're not really going to get into. But I wanted to focus on a couple of the things that they said. And one of those was that they were predicting certain events at roughly 80% accuracy in the NHL, which upon reading that, my first impression is there's no way that's true. That's snake oil, because if you had that, every team would want it. Should we be cautious about anyone who claims to have that kind of accuracy? I think of SAP a couple of years ago in the playoffs. Clearly they didn't. But you know, what's your first instinct when you hear a phrase like that?
Yes, I think that I definitely think that we should be cautious about anyone who's saying that they have 80% accuracy. I think there's likely a bit of marketing going on where you can claim 80% accuracy, even if you're looking at, let's say, in-sample, which is an entirely different and I don't want to say useless, but not particularly useful way of measuring your accuracy. You're spot on when you reference SAP's 86% or whatever claim. So if I had a company approach me and I was either me or a analytics professional working for a hockey organization and tell me that they had 80% accuracy, immediately I would be skeptical, not only on, you know, that stat, but also a lot of the other things that they're trying to sell, because it kind of calls into question, number one, whether you really understand, you know, how to build a metric, how to build a statistic that measures something. But also if you're measuring it that way, you know, are there going to be errors in your data collection? Are there going to be errors? Is there subjectivity in what you're collecting? And so I would be really super cautious. And, you know, if someone was, let's say, offering me that data for free, I think I would do a lot more checking and testing of their inputs, let alone their outputs, than I would for someone who came in at a much lower figure.
And I'm going to get to those inputs and outputs in a second, but just for someone who doesn't know, what do you mean when you say in sample versus say out of sample data?
So to say in sample would be if I got a whole bunch of data and I tried to build a model that would predict who was going to win a given game. So I had a team's Corsi and I had their number of hits and I had who their head coach was and a whole bunch of other variables. If I'm predicting in sample, it means that I use all that data to generate a model. And then I look at all the data that I used and I look at how frequently I got it right. So obviously I'm not going to be 100% because hockey's not that simple, but on an in-sample prediction, you could predict it pretty well because all the data that you use to build your model is the data that you're testing against. So your model is going to be really good at predicting your in-sample data because that was what it was built to do. When we look at out-of-sample, it's basically bringing in an entirely new set of data and looking at how well does the model that you've built predict games that it knows nothing about whatsoever. So all it knows is that, let's say that the team's courses and hits and the coaching, but it didn't know the result of that when it built the model. And so out of sample prediction is obviously a lot harder because you don't actually have the result when you build the model and when you come up with your predictions. And so as a result of that, you're going to end up with a lot lower accuracy, which is perfectly normal. And it's something that you just sort of, you accept, but it's also the proper way, for lack of a better term, to test whether whatever models you've built are actually good models. Because if you're great at predicting in sample, but not great at predicting out of sample, if you can't really predict the future, your model's not really useful at all. It could be entertaining, it could be interesting, but from the point of view of a decision maker who's trying to decide which players to use or which players to acquire, or who to trade or who to sign, a model that only tells you what happened and doesn't tell you what's going to happen isn't particularly useful.
And that's a great example. It's basically just how do you do against comparing things you don't know? And that's where it's important. You mentioned a bit about inputs and outputs. In this article specifically, a lot of what they focused on were outputs as on, I should rephrase that. A lot of what they focused on as far as the current analytics we have were outputs, and they compared that against a collection of inputs that and outputs that they used to create a basically war stat, a sum total stat, a rating out of 100. Should people be concerned when you've got a metric that uses a unknown combination of inputs and outputs in methods that are not divulged?
I think you have to be cautious, because there, I don't want to say that you should be completely skeptical all the time, because there's obviously people who are working for private companies who have access to, you know, very detailed micro data that are going to do like very good, rigorous work. But I think in this particular case, there's reason to be cautious, just because when you start blending inputs and outputs, you're going to get a bit of overlap. And I think one of the, you're going to get some overlap between the inputs and the outputs. So some of the inputs are going to be measuring the same things as some of the outputs are. So how you sort of break those up is going to be interesting. But also, if you're doing detailed testing, then ideally, when you start to do that, you're going to realize that certain things, whether they be the inputs or the outputs, should drop out. And really, if the inputs are what we think of as, let's say, skills or abilities, the inputs are the things that are going to be more likely to stick around, would be my sort of gut feeling, whereas the outputs are going to be the things that may have more more luck or more random variation in them. And therefore, if you're building a model, they may be more likely to drop out of the model or to be viewed as not, you know, useful by the model. Whereas the inputs, the things that are definitely going to repeat because they're a skill or they're an ability or they're a physical attribute of yours, should stick around. So if it's a blend of inputs and outputs, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's, you know, going to be a bad metric. But what it might often mean is that it's someone's subjective view of how these things should be blended together, which is usually a sort of a red flag for something that's not as rigorous or not as tested in as much detail as it should be.
And just again, for people who maybe aren't familiar with these terms, quick example of just a couple inputs and outputs that we would be familiar with in hockey.
So an output would be something like shot attempts. So how many shot attempts occur for or against a player on their shifts or while they're on the ice. An input would be something like, it could be as simple as their peak skating speed or their acceleration. I would consider it something like zone entries or the ability to enter the zone as an input. It's not necessarily what you're aiming to do, but it is something that eventually contributes to the things that you're aiming to do, which are generate shots and score goals.
All right, one final point on this article, and that was, it was one of my biggest frustrations as well, outside of the claims of fantastic accuracy, it was the method in which the author compared the two groups of centers. One was via a sum all total, and the other was just via raw Corsi 4 percentage, which, it's 2017 now. I think it's frustrating that is still being used as an argument, because I don't think anyone in the hockey analytics community who has any sort of status or platform to speak on agrees that that's the best way that we should look at players. It's not just twirling down a drop-down menu. There's more things to consider. There are numerous inputs, numerous outputs, and you can't just look at a single statistic and say, this is why they're good, or this is a good player. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I don't recall the last time, if ever, that I read a, let's say, analytics focused article that listed off, you know, here's their Corsi percentages, and this is the best player, the one at the top of the list. I think that almost everyone who does analytics writing right now or takes it seriously will almost go like out of their way to say, you know, he has a really good Corsi percentage and his Corsi rel is very good. But he's a below average shooter and his shot attempts against per 60 is higher than that of his teammates. So, you know, he's strong offensively, but may have defensive weaknesses and isn't a great finisher. Like, there's a lot of caveats, and most people have the understanding that what we do is limited and that any conclusions that we reach you know, have to be expressed in terms that state explicitly are sort of uncertainty with how attached some of these metrics are both to an individual player, but also with how directly some of these metrics will impact, you know, a player's overall results. And so I think it's a little, I don't want to say disingenuous, but it's a little frustrating to see someone who you know, knows better, who, mm-hmm. Who I believe at least tries to stay somewhat up to date on what's going on in the analytics community as a whole, even if it is sort of team specific or team focused, to have them just, you know, list off Corsi and say, well, this is how the Corsi people would make a decision, is definitely a frustrating way to paint what analysts are doing, particularly because, you know, it's a major platform that a lot of people will read, and you don't necessarily get the opportunity to rebut that with detailed arguments against that.
And that's the biggest thing. It's a platform that it's coming from is frustrating because it's not accurate. But it's like you said, you don't really get a chance to correct that. One final thing, I wanted to plug your work with Winner's View because you guys are doing some fantastic stuff there. The video pieces that are coming out, I'm really, really enjoying them. They're just quick hits, so if reading isn't your thing and you want to learn more about the newest discoveries in hockey analytics, check out Winner's View and the work that Matt is doing there with some of his excellent coworkers. Quick question, though, how do you think private companies are impacting and will impact the work in hockey statistics?
Well, first, thank you very much for the pitch, www.winnersview.com. But in terms of a private company, I had to do that. I haven't had an opportunity to do that.
I'm all for it. We're going to have another one at the end.
Excellent. In terms of private companies, I think there's a lot of companies that have access to really interesting data right now. And whether it's either, you know, camera tracked, automatically tracked, or, you know, companies that are doing manual tracking and putting together custom solutions, I think there will be a few companies who just have like an incredible impact in the long run, because they will have these systems that are, you know, the most accurate and the most reliable and track the things that matter and give access to the team, give the data to the teams in a format that they can use, whether it's for their analysts in a raw format or in a summary format for a manager or a decision maker. I think the point that we're at now, though, is that a lot of these companies, because they're just starting out and they're just starting to collect these, they've got so much data that they either, number one, don't know what to do with it all, and perhaps maybe hesitant to throw out some of the data that's less useful, because it's going to be things like, you know, how many hits in the corner did Chris Russell have on a Wednesday night, which is something that, you know, it's a traditional stat that may, you know, spark the mind of a coach and say, hey, that's something that I want to know, but it might not be actually the most useful thing. And I think having to keep these data collection systems that are probably necessarily collecting information that's not really all that useful may slow down the process of figuring out what is actually useful. So I think they'll have a tremendous impact on how the game develops in the front office. I'll be curious to see how much of that information actually seeps out to either the public analytics sphere or the public at large, and how much that impacts our being the analytics community understanding of the game. Because while they're doing all that work, there I'm sure will continue to be these great tracking projects where we'll get tons of great insights, which will, you know, likely go parallel alongside the information that, know, teams are starting to collect when they have this detailed data, but we'll never know that we're right, or that our data agrees with theirs, because we'll be working on one lane and they'll be working on another lane, and we'll be able to see what each other are doing. So
I would be really curious. Curiosity is to see how that seeps into the public sphere, and that's something I wanted to say. I really appreciate that you guys are doing at Winner's View. It's just the one, the work that's being put out into public, but two, I really loved that the work is not only being put out, but the logic behind it and the proof. You know, this is the p-value or the r-squared value is out there with it. You know, that does a lot for the credibility of the work being done beyond just the fact that your name or Manny's name or Dawson's name is attached to it.
Oh, well, I mean, one of the big things that we're hoping to accomplish is to sort of bring that rigor and that, you know, that strong statistical background and methodology to, you know, a 2-minute video where we get like 8 sentences. And so we're really pushing hard to make sure that we can fit as much, you know, detail and hardcore, you know, statistical background into it, while at the same time making it so that everyone will want to see it and not just stats nerds. So if I will say that if there's anything where you watch one of the pieces and it's a more technical piece or a less technical piece, and you think that we haven't explained something in full, please just shout at Manny or Dawson or myself or Aaron, our fearless leader on Twitter, and we will do our best to explain, because we do a lot of that work in the background if it doesn't make it into the video. And so we will hopefully have a way to, even if it's a 30 tweet long tweet chain with a little bit of game theory in it, to tell you the information that you're hopefully hoping to get. So we're always available and happy to answer any questions.
I don't think I've ever seen you guys do that on Twitter.
A 30 tweet chain?
No, that's uncommon.
No, it never happens.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for coming on today. I've really enjoyed this chat. It's been incredibly informative. I think you lived up to the hockey genius moniker. If not, you certainly proved that you're not a hockey idiot. So thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
If you want to go find Matt, you can check him out on Twitter at @Kane_Matt. You can read his work at puckplusplus.com, hockey-graphs.com, and winnersview.com. Go check him out. Look forward to the next episode coming out next week on Wednesday. Until then, have a good one.